night. We were in Providence, Rhode Island, and I'd never been there before. I got there, I think the ship was already docked, and they were waiting for me. Anyway, I piled on board, and they wanted to know why I was wearing my maritime uniform, and I told them that I didn't have any other clothes. So I guess the steward made a room ready for me, and I was back aft. The deck crew and officers lived in the bridge cabin, which was amidships. One of the problems was they were having with the D-Laval oil separator. So they had a representative come, and I put him up in my room, and the chief wanted to know why I was doing that, and I said, well, the guy was a Mason and I was going to take care of him. And the chief engineer was a Mason. I could tell there were rings. Well, anyway, we got the separator finished. The ship was empty. They brought a cargo of kerosene to make soap with, and they came from from Beaumont, Texas. And we were going back to Beaumont. The Standard Oil tankers all made domestic deliveries. They all belonged to the Standard Oil bunch. Esso, Standard Oil of, I guess it was Texas in those days, made all the foreign runs. Well, anyway, everything was settled in, and I went down to Beaumont and got a haircut when we were in port. They loaded the tanker and we started back, came back. And I don't remember what port we came to, but anyway, my father wanted money to buy the property on Burpee Avenue. And he didn't have any until he would sell the Jackson Street house. So he wanted me to give him $1,000. And I finally gave it to him with a note, promissory note, at 4% interest. Because I told him, I need that money to go to school, and that's what I've been working for. So I went back to New York, stayed at the YMCA, William Sloan House, where I stayed with Ernie when we were shipping on the unlicensed jobs, and tried to get back with Standard Oil, and they said they were sorry. You left the ship, and the man you relieved had to come back early, and he's not going to get off again, and we don't have a job for you. I have to wait. So I was running out of money. I didn't have money in the bank or anything. I just had the money I carried with me. And I went to Army Transport because they were bringing the brides back from Europe and the military stuff they weren't destroying or giving away. So while I was on shore duty and laying up ships, why, I was in the office, and a captain saw me and wanted to know if I was free to go and take a ship to Japan. And that was exactly what I wanted to do. because I'd never been to Japan, and I thought this was about the last time I'd have to get there. So I went on the Waterfall Victory. The ship was all loaded.
Loaded with what?
A Pepsi-Cola plant. They had all of the bottling equipment and all of the Pepsis packed in overseas shipment boxes, cartons, cases. And there was something else in the cargo which I don't recall. But anyway, we were to deliver it to Japan. So I went aboard and immediately got underway, and we went out and we swung compass. That is, they would test the deviation for the magnetic compass. And of course there wasn't any war on anymore, and there weren't any submarines. So we went directly to Panama, to Colón. And while I was home, a few days I was there, I got my camera and some other equipment, a film tank, and I decided I'd develop my own film on the Victory ship. So the power plant was all new. We went to Colón and we were having trouble with boiler leaks at the U-bins of the superheater tubes. And they were going to replace them, but they didn't have any, so they had to order replacements. Well, we laid at Colón, I think, for a day and a half.
And this is 1946. About when? Summer?
Yeah. It was about summertime. So I took some pictures with the speed graphic of the ship in. Yeah, I got the mic on. If you have any questions, why, stop me and we'll go back and answer them. But anyway, the Waterville Victory had two 3rd assistant engineers, and I was the junior. And the guy that was the senior 3rd assistant was a diesel man, and he was a Jew from Palestine, or from Israel.
And his name was?
I don't know. I don't know any of their names. There was a second assistant and first assistant that worked only the daytime. The captain was a regular ATS man, and so are the rest of them. And this was hard for me to take because they did everything differently than we did on the other merchant ships. I took my speed graphic with me, and I was taking pictures of the ship and tied up in Colón, ready to go in the locks. And they arrested me and took me and the camera to some security place because the wartime restrictions on photography hadn't been lifted yet.
You didn't know that?
I didn't know that. So they were going to take the camera away from me, and I persuaded them that the war was over and I didn't have any pictures of the locks. So, how about giving me the camera back? And they didn't think that would be a good idea. I think one of them wanted it. I had the camera and the light meter and a film tank with me. So I persuaded them to let me take the film out of the holders and give it to them. There weren't any pictures on them yet because it hadn't been developed. So they let me go. And I went to the, I think, the Seaman's Club, and had a beer or something, and we got ready to go through the canal. We worked on the superheaters. I didn't have to do any work. They had a shore crew work on it, and they tried to tighten up the U-bends. They were U-shaped, bolted to the ends of the superheater. And this was the first ship I was on with a superheater. And one of my assignments was the lube oil system on the main turbine. And they had an evaporator. And they also had a leaky atmospheric valve. And it leaked so much that we couldn't, with the evaporator making water 24 hours a day, evaporator making 24 hours a day, couldn't keep up. So we called the ship, the Waterville, the Mystery Victory. We didn't know where the water went, but if you were outside on deck and you were near the stack, you got wet from the water that was escaping. We had a stage of feed water heaters, which I never had been encountered before, and the ship would make about 16 miles an hour. We left Balboa on the Pacific side and headed for Japan. All the time we were running low on water. They took the evaporator, took seawater, and made double or triple distilled water out of it to feed the boilers. They were high-pressure boilers, 450 pounds at about 900 degrees Fahrenheit. So we got out in the Pacific and were rolling along, and suddenly everything on the ship stopped. The plant shut down, everything. Generators, steering gear, all the auxiliaries. There were no lights any place, and we're just sitting on the ocean swells.
Was it daytime or not?
It was daytime. The assistant let the deaerator go dry, and the deaerator feeds the feed pump, and the feed pump was a turbine drive, and it was a centrifugal pump, so when they didn't get any water, it tripped off, and that shut the plant down. So there we were, rocking on the Pacific, out of control. So they woke me up, and the electricians ran the diesel generator. They had a good-sized diesel electric plant because the ship had carried a 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft to double-duty gun. The guns were all gone now, but the gun tubs were still there. And they had trouble starting it. Well, of course they had trouble. They didn't set the governor to feed it any fuel. So I explained how the thing should be run. And I was in my shorts and a pair of wooden go-aheads.
Go-aheads? What are go-aheads?
Well, that's what we call the wooden shoes that we made out of ends of orange crates with a strap across your foot to keep them on. You never carried them off the ship. You just made a new pair when you came on board to go in the shower. so I couldn't do anything to help them down below. But anyway, the next morning they'd relieved the senior third assistant and gave him my position, and I took his. I didn't get any more money, and I should have, but anyway, I worked different shift. I think I worked the 4 to 8 instead of the, no, I worked the 4 to 8 watch would be the first engineer's watch on the Liberty. And that gave me a little more muscle because the chief engineer realized that I knew how to run the power plant. Well, we continued across the Pacific and we came to the Japanese islands. And we went to, port's name. It wasn't, we went to two ports. We picked up a pilot and went in and tied the ship up and prepared to take off some of the cargo. We went to Nagasaki, and there the water barge came alongside immediately, and the chief engineer, Walsh, got sick. So the chief engineer was relieved, and he went back to the States. I think his wife had polio. So we got a new chief engineer. I didn't know any of the officers. We ate in the dining room with the captain. It was the rear room, just the officers ate there. It was pretty much high living. And we unloaded part of our cargo. And then we went around to Kobe. And I think we unloaded the rest of it there. And at Kobe, I visited a steel mill. They made steel, and they had the steel piled up in ingots as high as the building would allow. And because I've been a chemist at Weir Steel, I wanted to go to the chemical lab. And I think there was one other crew member with me. I got acquainted with the radio operator, and he came from Long Island. And I can say more about that when we get back. But anyway, they emptied the ship, and during that time I went to Tokyo, and I went to a place called Kamakuri, where the Smiling Buddha was. It was supposed to be a good place to visit. At Kamakuri, I got a Jap to take the picture of the first engineer, I think, and the radio operator, and myself by the Smiling Buddha, and I still have a picture. I also have the glass negative that the Japanese that took the picture was using, and he developed it for me. I hung around Kamakuri all day. He developed the film, made me a picture, gave me the print, and he gave the first assistant a print, and I think the radio operator. I'll have to look when I get home to see who was all on the picture. But anyway, that was a nice day. We rode the train, and they rode with the Japanese on board, and it was a pleasant day, I remember. Kobe had been firebombed, and there was nothing but burned buildings. The railroad tracks and the subway got so hot that they curled up in curls. The railroad was wrecked. Everything was wrecked. I went to the officers' club and was welcomed. It was run by a bunch of Masons, and they invited me to join them. All I had to do was bring a quart of whiskey, and they had a place on the shelf for me, and when I came in, I could have a drink. So I visited them once, I think, and then I took a rickshaw back to the ship. The black market was operating, and the whiskey I'd gotten in Panama, and I was saving it for some good occasion, so I figured this was it. One of the interesting things that happened, I was waiting by myself for a train, I can't remember where, but there was a lot of Japanese around, and there was a number of Japanese girls. And suddenly one of them came over to me and said, I'd be your girl, and took hold of my sleeve. And the MPs came through, and they were looking for Chinese whores, and they were taking a lot of the young girls. Well, they saw me with one, and she held on to me, and they came over and they said, who's this? Well, I said, this is my girl. And they said, oh, all right, we'll leave her go. Go and have a good time. So she thanked me profusely in poor English and went and caught her train. But she didn't get arrested. The black market was going big guns, and somebody had taken a 100-pound sack of sugar, which was one of the most expensive black market items.
Off of the ship?
They took it out of the storeroom and left it in the alleyway. So I got a pillowcase and cut the bottom out of it, filled it with sugar, and put it in the crotch of my pants and went ashore. And I think I got enough yen for it so that I didn't have to pay for anything out of my ship's money. Well, at Kobe, they sent us back to the States. And they didn't send us to New York, they sent us to San Francisco, which I'd been to before. So I rode the ship to go home, and we stopped in Honolulu for 4 or 5 days while I worked on the superheater. And while we were in Honolulu, they put us up at Pearl Harbor, and the Navy pilot brought us in and very nearly ran down a Navy tug. If it hadn't been for the captain dropping the anchor to stop the ship, we'd have cut the tub in half. So the radio operator and I were now like good friends. So we went and rented a Jeep. It used to be an Army Jeep. And at Pearl, we were going to be there several days. So we took the Jeep, filled it with gas, and I picked up a Kodak 35mm camera that had something wrong with the rewind mechanism, and there was a Kodak factory in Honolulu. So I went there and got the camera fixed, and then the radio on operator and I drove around the island of Oahu. We drove out to the point that is real famous, and we kept right on going around the island. I went down the north side, and we decided we'd go swimming, and the beach was posted, no swimming, undertow, but we tried it anyway. And I think I was never so frightened in my life, because the undertow got me and I couldn't get to shore. I finally made it and we didn't go in the water anymore.
Shouldn't think so.
How are we doing? Okay, we're back talking on the tape. And I want to correct myself. I was at Yokohama and Kobe, not Nagasaki. And the trip to Japan was strictly a cruise I wanted to take. I had hoped to get to Japan before, but I never was able to. So this was it. Now, what were some of the other things you wanted?
Oh, selling the sugar on the black market.
Oh, well, Agnes wants to know how I sold sugar on the black market. Well, the sugar sack was in the passageway down the first level on the Victory, and I took a pillowcase and cut it off, and I saved the bottom part, put the sugar in, and I waddled off the ship with the pillowcase between my legs. And there was no way that you couldn't get rid of it. There was buyers all around, and they would come up to you and ask you what you had, and they would want to buy it. I don't remember what I sold it for, but it was worth the trouble. The fence was a 6-foot chain link fence around the area that the ship was in, and we were going to unload there some of our Pepsi Cola stuff. And then I went to Kamakura, and I think I covered that. And got pictures of the smiling Buddha, which was supposed to be the one of the largest in the world. And in general, Japan was real fine. From Yokohama, we went to Kobe, and Kobe was a repeat of Yokohama. I don't think went ashore there at all, because we were supposed to go back to the States. Now, what were some of the other things?
How long did it take you to get to Japan, and what time of year did this whole voyage go over?
Well, I think we got to Japan sometime in the summer.
And that's 46?
And that would be in 46. And I was thought of something else. We were still having trouble with the power plant, and I was still on the senior third. I didn't have sense enough to demand that the higher wages, but we'll let that go. So we left Japan and we went back to Hawaii. And this time in Hawaii, they had us up in Pearl Harbor. And we were lucky to get there. We needed water again, and they were supposed to fix the U-bends where they were leaking. And I think there was trouble with the main reduction gears on the turbine. The turbine was a General Electric, but the gears, which were transferring power to the propeller shaft, were made in Scotland. And something in their production wasn't right or their assembly. Now at Pearl, we were alongside a wharf, and there was stuff in the wharf that didn't interest me. I never found out what it was until there was a search made of the ship. I was asleep in my room when the MPs came through, and of course I woke up and they wanted me to get dressed, and they kind of took the cabin apart, and I couldn't understand what the trouble was. But I was sort of warned by the captain the day before. He asked me if I had any cigarettes, and I told him no, I didn't smoke. And the MPs were looking for stolen cases of cigarettes. It seems that our electricians, and there were three of them, had gone in the warehouse and helped themselves. And cigarettes were a very high price commodity in all of the ports because the soldiers. I was talking about the cigarettes, and they spent some time in the second engineer's room, and when we had our noon dinner, why, it came out that quite a few cases had been stolen, and they locked up the three electricians in the brig, and they didn't do anything except hassle a second engineer. And of course I didn't have any, so I was clean. And the captain really smiled at me when we went into the wardroom for lunch. I'm trying to think of what other things that might be interesting. I guess I will go back to the ship, and I got the radio operator, who was became a good friend, and we rented a Jeep, a civilian Jeep, and proceeded to drive around Oahu. We went out to Diamond Head, and we went along the North Shore. We went to some of the other towns that were on the highway, and we generally spent a whole day at it. I'd gotten a day off, and in port he had gone up to the Standards Association, and he had some complaints about the time ticks to get the correct time for the navigators. And he apparently could take code faster than the guys at the Bureau of Standards could read it. And he was from Long Island, and I visited his house one time when we got back. We left Honolulu, Pearl Harbor, and came home directly to San Francisco. We got into Frisco, and they put the ship over in Oakland, and I didn't say anything about paying off, and I decided that I'd better, because if I got stuck on the ship in the out in the boondock someplace, they would forget me. And I was beginning to want to get back home. When we went through the Panama Canal, I wrote the Dean of Engineering School.
This is on the
in on the way over and asked to be enrolled.
At University of Wisconsin?
Hmm?
Yeah, at the University
of Wisconsin Engineering School. Well, I had heard from him, and I was going to go home. I had transportation to New York City, and the first engineer was promoted to an attack transport, which carried passengers, and it was fitted out to bring officers home from the Far East. I went aboard with him, and he had a suite of rooms on the boat deck, and right down the hall were five nurses, so I figured he would be glad to pay off. So everybody was going to pay off, so I decided I would too. And I had a interview with a Captain Clark in Army Port of Embarkation, and he was the one that put me on the Victory. Well, he was in San Francisco, and we were at were to pay off over in Frisco instead of, where did I say we were?
Yeah.
Oakland. So I got in the cab with the rest of the bunch and went over to Fort Mason. It was the oldest establishment by the Army. It was a permanent base, was near the approach to the Brooklyn Bridge.
It can't have been Brooklyn if this is San Francisco. Golden Gate?
Oh, the Golden Gate Bridge, yeah. And Captain Clark was there and was disappointed because I was getting off. Well, anyway, I paid off. I got my gear together. And now that I was an officer, I could fly. So I got a plane ticket and I went to Chicago. And instead of going on to New York, I got on the train and went to Green Bay. And I guess it was there when I got the letter saying I could enter the University of Wisconsin. So I went down to the University and signed in, and I needed a place to live.
Oh, this must have been the summer of 46?
Yep.
Okay, you needed a place to live?
Yeah, well, this was real late in the year. I'm kind of mixed up on what happened, but anyway, I was admitted. And I went back home and stayed there until the university opened. And the rest is not very interesting. But I remember it was late and I was home for Christmas and I had talked to Pete Falk. And he wanted me to go out on the Havana Nassau race. And my mother complained because I wasn't going to stay home. So I stayed home and I helped Dad put the material together for the living room in the new house on Beaupré Avenue. And of course that was built while I wasn't around. And they put me up in what was going to be the guest room in the basement. And as I recall, Fritz was in the second bedroom on the first floor. And they had four semesters a year at Wisconsin. and the only place they found for me to stay was in the barracks at Truex Field, and that necessitated a bus ride in every morning or every time I wanted to go to school. So I went, I was stayed home for Christmas that year, and I must have gone back in January and went to school in January, because I remember they had a snowstorm and everything stopped in Madison, and the snow drifted up to on the barracks I was in so that you could walk off the roof and onto the snowbank. And that, I think, will end our conversation and tape, because I've now become a civilian again.